Welcome to Attention Talk Radio, the show centered around paying attention to attention, with your host, Attention Coach Jeff Copper.
Welcome, everybody, to this edition of Attention Talk Radio. I'm your host, Attention Coach Jeff Copper. Tonight is Wednesday, April the 10th in the year 2013 at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We have an exciting topic tonight, the impact of stigma on ADHD, and with us in our virtual studio is Dr. Stephen Henshaw. Tonight is the eve of the ADHD Organization Coaches Conference, which right now I'm in route to as we speak. So this this call has been pre-recorded, and we will run it in its entirety and just shortly. And I know you'll be excited about it. But real quick, some announcements. The CHAD is having their regional conference this year in Dallas, Texas. It's in early May. For more information on that, go to chadd.org. It's a one-day affair, and if you're anywhere in the area or can get there by plane, I highly suggest it. CHAD conferences are always very exciting. Matter of fact, my exposure to Dr. Henshaw was in preparation for last year's CHAD conference and at the conference with his keynote address. As a reminder out there, for those of you who enjoy Attention Talk Radio, don't forget to check out Attention Talk Video. That's our talk show on YouTube. And also, we have Attention Talk News. For many of you who don't like to check websites or don't go to our Facebook page or whatever, you can sign up for Attention Talk News, and we will keep you abreast of past shows, current shows, and other ADHD information submitted by guest writers, other videos, and other podcasts. So, again, tonight our topic is the impact of stigma on ADHD. Dr. Henshaw is in our virtual studio. And real quickly, Dr. Henshaw received his BA in Psychology and Social Relations from Harvard, summa cum laude, and his PhD in Clinical Psychology from UCLA in 1983. He was a postdoctoral fellow at UC San Francisco, and after teaching at UCLA, joined Berkeley faculty in 1990. He's an expert in the developmental psychopathology and the stigma of mental illness. He has particular expertise in childhood behavior disorders, attention disorders, and hyperactivity, stigma associated with mental disorders, and other factors related to mental disorders. Dr. Henshaw has published over 200 articles, chapters, and reviews, and is author of 7 books. He's received over $13 million in federal research grants and is the past president of the International Society for Research in Children and Adolescent Psychopathology and the Society of Clinical Child and Adolescent Psychology. He's the editor of the Psychological Bulletin, the most cited journal in psychology, and is the recipient of the Distinguished Teaching Award from Colleges of Letters and Sciences at Berkeley. So quite a biography. So again, this show is taped. I'm going to roll the tape here in just a second and click back and enjoy it. Do take notes, Dr. Henshaw. I personally learned an enormous amount from this particular episode, particularly when he starts talking about the issues with ADHD and the nature of stigma. It really it's really enlightening. So without any further ado, we'll roll a tape and enjoy the show. Dr. Henshaw, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
This is a show that I never thought of doing until I heard you speak at the 2012 CHAD conference, and I have to tell you, you did a great job in your presentation. There was so much about stigma that I had really not thought about, and since Attention Talk Radio really kind of came about, as we like to pay attention to attention, and when I look at stigma, there's a lot to pay attention to here. So if we can begin with, can you just describe what stigma is?
So back in the olden days of ancient Greece, stigma, a fine Greek word, like most psychological and psychiatric terms, signaled if you were at the agora, the marketplace, it might be important for the Athenian citizen to know who was a slave or a traitor, who was definitely on the out-group side of society, and a literal mark or brand would be placed on the face or shoulder of one of the non-citizens at the agora. And today, stigma has a much more psychological connotation than a physical mark or brand. If you're a member of a certain racial or ethnic group, or you're a member of another kind of less visible group, but one that society devalues, there's a lot of stigma. We stereotype how you people are. We might form prejudice and not like such people and actually discriminate, take rights away. And the big point about stigma is that everything about that person in that stigmatized group emanates from that group membership. So they really never have a fighting chance. And sort of the final initial point is that if you had to pick the bottom three attributes, the group membership you might have in today's society that are most stigmatized, are you homeless, do you abuse substances, or do you have mental illness?
Mm-hmm.
At an overt level, most people in society are very wary around those three things. It's threatening, there but for the grace of God go I. You must not be trying hard enough. I try very hard to get it together. Whole lots of reasons why these psychological attributes, especially mental illness, receive so much stigma today.
It's interesting. As you describe that, I got a question, because you were talking about stigma and this, and use the word prejudice. Is it natural? I mean, because it seems to me that some prejudices, just if I go back in, like, you know, the jungle or whatever, and go to like primitive type brain, if you will, prejudice. I can see how sometimes it can actually maybe be a good thing to ward off trouble. Does that play into this? I'm just kind of curious. I mean, to me, to a certain extent, prejudice is a little natural.
Well, this is an excellent point, and the social psychologists will tell us, and the evolutionary psychologists will tell us some important things. When we evolved as a species 100,000 years ago, we humans had to be very social. We had to outsmart these big predators of ours that were hairier and stronger and bigger than we were.
Mm-hmm.
And one way to do that was to be really social and form bonds, and society is kind of ingrained into us. But at the same time, if early humans were unbelievably social all the time and everybody was a friend, you could get exploited.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be that, although it's hard to prove these evolutionary things because behavior, as they say, doesn't leave fossils, but if you look diseased, chronic illness, that might be catching. That might be a kind of automatic module in our brains to promote stigma. Or if you're going to cheat me, or you don't have enough social capital, or if you really look or act different, you're a member of a different tribe, so to speak, or a different cultural group. Those are the three things that tend to automatically make people cautious. So there may be a bit of an inborn prejudice and stigma. Now, it's one thing to have that kind of automatic fear reaction, but in today's society, where we have to get along more than ever before in this unbelievably competitive world, in this pluralistic society we have, we do have big frontal lobes, and we do have big capacity for empathy. And where stigma really gets pernicious is, so let's talk about the discrimination that's involved. In many states in our country, as I sometimes say, half tongue in cheek, if you're crazy enough to admit you have a mental illness, you can't vote, you lose custody of your kids, you can't run for office, you can't serve on a jury, and you lose your driver's license. Now, if my vision is 20/200 uncorrected, please take my license away. But I have a history of depression, or my mom and dad had ADHD, and I may too, therefore I can't vote or run for office. As we sometimes say, it's a good thing in 1860 such laws were in place. Lincoln could have never run for president with his severe depressions and probably manic episodes that he had from time to time. So stigma becomes really a problem when there's no link between what's being stigmatized and the rights we take away. Again, if you can't see well, you shouldn't drive unless we can correct your vision. But a history of mental illness should not take fundamental rights away.
And everybody, we've covered a lot of territory. So, Dr. Henshaw, I want to kind of back up for a second. You talked about stigma as being like a signal. In the old days, it was a physical mark. Now, to me, it's more of an intangible and judgmental. But you also, when I heard you speak, talk about the properties of stigma, and you kind of covered them a little bit already. If I remember correctly, one is there's a negative tone, two is the stereotype that leads to discrimination, and it's the pervasive devaluation of that I guess that judgment. Is that accurate?
That's a really good summation of the sort of social psychology of stigma. As I sometimes say, as a UC Berkeley professor, I never stereotype anybody except Stanford students and professors are tribal. We're a private school, and they wear red, and we wear blue. And stereotyping is, we all have to stereotype a little bit. There's just too much social information out there to keep all the millions of pieces of data in mind. But if my stereotype leads me to not like anybody who wears red from Stanford and not let them in my classes, even as an extension student, my stereotyping has melded over into prejudice. I'm prejudging. I know everything bad about you before I've met you. And discrimination. I'm going to take your rights away for no really good reason. And so there may be a natural part of stigma, but when it takes rights away unjustifiably, it's a problem. And there's two other big points. Most people who are stigmatized, you belong to a group that society is not a fan of.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you've been under a rock for a long time, you know what society's stereotypes are. They're in the newspaper, they're in jokes, they're in family lore.
Yep.
And self-stigma, you're taking on that stigma yourself, predicts what? Never getting treatment, never admitting you have any issues, dropping out of treatment if you even started. So self-stigmatization is a huge problem that is a major contributor to why so many people with ADHD, depression, bipolar disorder, you name it, never get help for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Number two is a concept termed by Goffman, the famous sociologist who taught at Berkeley 50, 60 years ago, who did all these original, incredible studies. He said, look, if you're a member of a stigmatized group, it's only courteous for society to stigmatize those around you and close to you. He called it courtesy stigma.
Mm-hmm.
So the colleagues of, and especially the family members of a stigmatized group, are themselves stigmatized. Now, think about the history of mental health in the United States. For much of the 20th century, this was compounded by the fact that clinical psychology and psychiatry essentially said, if your offspring has a mental illness, ADHD, bipolar disorder, et cetera, it was caused by bad parenting.
Mm-hmm.
Schizophrenia is caused by schizophrenogenic mothers who were hostile and rejecting, and ADHD is caused by lax parenting. So not only do the families receive courtesy stigma, but also psychiatrically they're blamed for the condition. And that's a setup for run the other direction, don't admit your kid or your family member has a problem, and for gosh sakes, don't get an assessment and a label because then the stigma's confirmed. So
mm-hmm.
this is a huge problem.
So just to put this in context, is we at the top of the show we define stigma, but there's really kind of, as I understand, there's two subsets as you're describing, is the internalized stigma and the what we call courtesy stigma, and the internalized is you actually internalize it and you begin to actually take on the attributes of that stigma. Is that
it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. I
yep.
guess I'm no good in the way that the societal stereotypes told me that my group was. And demoralization, not seeking jobs, not thinking you're worthy, and certainly the really interesting and really troubling research shows that even when you take out of the equation symptoms of depression, if you have depression, or symptoms of ADHD, if you have ADHD, both of which can lead to problems concentrating and
yep.
problems with, you know, staying with morale. The amount of self-stigma you have, the amount that you've internalized society's views, predicts never getting started with treatment or dropping out early if you started. So now we've got the full vicious cycle. People who need help aren't getting it because
yep.
of self-stigma.
I can't help but just, it was interesting one time, I was interviewing, I believe it was Dr. Kevin some time ago, and he brought up the notion of the love, I forget how he put it, how ADHD kind of loved depression, and what he described it is you have ADHD, if you act kind of depressed, you're rewarded for that behavior to a certain extent. And so it was interesting how he would describe it and I don't know any research about it, but I just thought it was kind of funny because it kind of self-fulfills itself after a while. The more you act depressed, the more you reward for it, the more you kind of get depressed. So in this, in a weird kind of way, I mean, it's not the same thing, but internal stigma is you kind of take on that stuff, and it actually makes it worse as time goes on because you're not going to go seek the things that you need. And one of the things that you said at the conference I thought was powerful is we need to go meet these individuals where they are.
Right.
And help work with them to pull them out. Am I accurate in what I've just described?
Yeah, I mean, I said a couple of things, and one was, look, how does the media continue to portray people with various forms of mental illness as violent, dangerous, or incompetent?
Yep.
Or sometimes, intriguingly, as a superhero, John Nash in A Beautiful Mind.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you're really crazy. Well, crazy has some good connotations in street lingo these days.
Mm-hmm.
Where's the everyday struggles, the essential normality? Everybody's stressed out these days. Everybody's trying to cope and make it. And when the media portrayals are that you're vilified or that you're a superhero, the actual normal day-to-day responses, the everyday stories of heroism and struggle get ignored, and stigma only grows.
Wow. Which I want to kind of, it's a whole other point, but I got to hold off on it. So we talked about stigma, we talked about subset of internalized stigma, but there's also, as you described, courtesy stigma, which is lumping up everybody else associated into that. One of the things that kind of jumps out to me is if there's a family member that's stigmatized, that association is always kind of like it's only courtesy to stigmatize everybody else in the family, which becomes a very large burden. Am I interpreting that correctly?
Exactly, and I really think it goes beyond family members.
Mm-hmm.
Who are some of the least valued psychologists, clinical psychologists? Who are some of the least valued medical doctors, psychiatrists? Because we work with people who have mental illness. We're victims of courtesy stigma ourselves.
Oh, wow.
Right? And
that's
so
profound.
And troublingly, a number of years ago, a book by Otto Wahl, W-A-H-L, a psychologist colleague of ours, called Telling is Risky Business. He did a survey of 2,000 members of NAMI, National Alliance on Mental Illness, around the United States, asked them a lot about symptoms and stigma, and the number one source of stigma many people reported was from their treatment providers and the settings in which they got care because of the low expectations.
Wow.
And because sometimes of even the jokes in the emergency room, the whole profession in some ways is looking for an identity that rises out of stigma. And so we professionals are inadvertently contributing to the whole problem. So it's not only family members, work colleagues, but the very professions supposed to be caring for and treating people with mental and emotional problems. We need to get our act together and look at the stigma we ourselves receive. And one of my solutions, if I'm not the only one, is many people in the mental health professions came into it because of family issues and struggles with themselves. To the extent we can own it and disclose it and be honest, a big contributor to stigma is silence. We can't talk about this.
Yeah.
It's too shameful, and that's true for people who aren't getting services, and it's true for professionals and scientists as well.
I want to come back to that after the break, but I just want to repeat, I think, what you had just said, which was just amazing to me. The profession looks for identity that actually rises out of stigma. So it's like, I never thought about that before, but that like smacks me right in the face. Like, I never thought of it that way, but I can see that. It's blows me away.
Troubling, yes.
We need to go to a break. For our listeners out there who want to learn more, the best place for them to go would be the website. That's berkeley.edu.
UC Berkeley, www.berkeley.edu. And the psychology department homepage is a click away. And all my colleagues and the faculty and me are right there and welcome you to take a look.
All right. With that, we'll be right back after these messages.
Your life, your world, your choice. This is Attention Talk Radio. We are CHAD, the nation's leading nonprofit organization serving the community impacted by ADHD. CHAD and Attention Magazine provide science-based information about ADHD to families, professionals, the media, and the general public. Attention is the only publication in which your paid advertising promotes the mission of leadership, advocacy, research, education, and support for the ADHD community. Interested? Advertise in Attention Magazine and CHAD's website at chadd.org or call 240-487-2314.
The average annual cost of attending college starts around $25,000. Students who have ADHD are at high risk of dropping out because they haven't learned the critical skills they need to succeed in school. Protect your investment with an Edge Foundation coach, specifically trained to help students with ADHD and executive function impairment make the transition from high school to college. Visit edgefoundation.org to learn more.
Make every moment count with Time Timer, a sensitive solution for ADHD time management. It shows how much time is left using a bright red disc that gets smaller as time passes. To place an order for a Time Timer, all you have to remember is TimeTimer.com.
You deserve the best-trained ADHD coach. Find one at the ADD Coach Academy, the only comprehensive ADHD coach training program accredited by the International Coach Federation. Go to addca.com and click on Find a Coach.
And now, back to Attention Talk Radio.
Welcome back, everybody, to this edition of Attention Talk Radio. We've got Dr. Stephen Henshaw in our virtual studio today, and we're having a spirited discussion on stigma. At the before the break, we talked about really what it was. We looked at kind of its properties and kind of the two subsets, internalizing kind of currency stigma. And before the break, I had mentioned something that I wanted to come back to, and I have to say I forgot it, Dr. Henshaw. So I hope that either you remember it or we can pick it up along the way.
Well, what we were just starting to talk about was that when we talk about courtesy stigma or associated stigma, that the people around the person who stigmatized themselves receive castigation, that includes not just family members, but professionals. Because the professions of clinical psychology and psychiatry are in some ways the least valued among psychologists and medical doctors, and because we work with people who are, quote, crazy and have mental illness, and people with mental illness may, in fact, feel way too often that they're not getting full respect from the very professionals treating them because everybody's in some ways a victim of this stigma. So it's a big issue.
This is a really fascinating conversation. I want to kind of turn the ship a little bit and take a look at the stigma of ADD because you made some points that really stood out for me. And you used the term of roller coaster, but those with ADHD, I mean, sometimes they can kind of get up there and perform and sometimes they can't. And that kind of roller coaster just lends itself to me to the exacerbation of all this. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, it's a really good point. So if you look at the world's research literature on stigma in terms of mental illness, there's a whole lot on schizophrenia, a devastating condition, usually starting in late adolescence, bipolar disorder, the terrible mood swings that so often predict suicidality and terrible life impairment, severe depression, severe anxiety disorders. And then you think, well, wait a minute, ADHD, it's an impairing condition, but most people with ADHD look pretty good a lot of the time. The prototypic kid is doing fine until he or she gets to the really hard school subject, or homework is okay some days and not so good other days. And same with the workplace for an adult. It's inconsistent, but it's not as relentlessly severe as, say, schizophrenia or bipolar disorder. So ADHD would receive a lot less stigma, right? Well, maybe not so fast. One thing that stands out is some studies done not too long ago looking at individuals with autism. You can have kids with very severe autistic disorder who don't speak much at all and have terrible social isolation. And then there's a group that's been called individuals with Asperger's condition or disorder, may now all be with DSM-5, part of a larger autism spectrum disorder. Not as severe, some very focused interests, but social in some ways, and quite verbal and intelligent. Which receives more stigma? The high-functioning Asperger's rather than severe autism, precisely because, hey, he or she looks like they can get it together most of the time. It must be lack of effort. And similarly with ADHD, compared again to where a lot of the focus has been on a chronic condition like schizophrenia, ADHD may be chronic, but it fluctuates day to day, and people do well in setting A versus B. But because of that, what does a large percentage of the public undoubtedly think? What's the matter with her? Why can't she get it together all the time? She looked fine in period one. What about period four? And it's an interesting phenomenon. We tend to blame and stigmatize when we feel that the person could have, would have, should have had it under control. If I see some unusual behavior on the subway or train, and I think, oh, boy, that was a person just kind of acting out, I'm going to blame that person and stigmatize. That was a seizure, totally out of control. Probably feel a bit of empathy and not much blame.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the ideas has been, for conditions like ADHD and other mental conditions, let's take it slow. Let's say we know there's a strong biological underpinning. We know that genes have a lot to do with predicting ADHD. And if we could just convince the public that, in fact, this behavior that looks fluctuating and it looks like the person could control it, just isn't trying, is, in fact, a biologically based brain disorder. On the face of it, that should be the solution for stigma. But there's a catch. That seems to work with physical illnesses, but when the behavior of a so-called mental illness is a bit threatening and unpredictable, when we think that's 100% genetic, the public may actually feel you're flawed to your very core, even at the level of your DNA. If we think a condition is 100% biological, we might blame the person a bit less, but we actually punish them more when they violate social rules. In truth, ADHD has a strong biological basis, but getting treatment, trying, I'm not saying ADHD is a disorder of not trying, but trying to get a network around you to get better performance makes a difference. It's genes and it's effort. It's biology and it's culture. I mean, ADHD genes have been around for as long as we've been a species, if not before. But when did ADHD become really salient? When we made kids go to school, compulsory education. So there's a cultural component as well as a biological component. And I think in many ways the antidote to stigma is not saying exclusively it's a brain disorder, certainly not saying, well, it's just people aren't trying hard enough. That's not true, and that's stigmatizing. But conveying and portraying the day-to-day struggles, do you take medicine or not? Do you get involved in a cognitive behavioral program? Do you get coaching? Are you working at it? Where do you fail? Where do you succeed? Where are the day-to-day triumphs? That's humanizing. What we really need to do as an antidote to stigma is show the humanity of everyone who might have a so-called mental affliction or condition they're struggling with. Because when everybody's human, empathy flows. If you're a hero or a villain, or you're solely the product of deficient genes, you're somewhat subhuman. And what do dictators do throughout history if they want to repress or even exterminate a subgroup? They make them subhuman. Hitler's calling Jews, as well as people with mental illness, vermin. So stigma is really, that the solution to it is about humanization, better media portrayals of everyday struggles, and communication and contact.
That's interesting. So just the everyday struggles humanizes it, which leads to empathy. And empathy, when I think of empathy, when people are empathetic, that at that point in time they turn, they actually kind of want to help.
That's right.
It kind of reverses that cycle a little bit by just talking about it on a day, like here's the everyday struggles that a person kind of goes through. That's fascinating.
I mean, even the term, the mentally ill, mental illness, you change one word in an experimental study from a vignette about somebody has a physical illness to a mental illness, all of a sudden that single change from physical to mental and people responding to a questionnaire about this unknown person you've just heard described start to say that person isn't as fully human as other people.
Yeah,
mental
just
illness creates fear and threat, and but when you get to know somebody, a family member, a work colleague, a student in your kid's school, who's really struggling, yet is a real live human being and kid with laughter as well as tears,
yep.
Empathy flows, and it's not just a label anymore.
What jumps out at me is you have the physical world. As a coach, at the end of the day, as I've described to people, all we do is coach attention at the end of the day. I can't change anybody, but you can. Your behavior will change if you change what you're paying attention. But, you know, only the person, like only the individual who's paying attention can actually observe it. And so it's this intangible thing out there that's kind of nebulous. And the thing that I've learned, my brother's mechanical engineering, and when he wants to convince somebody, he just runs an experiment because they can physically see it.
Right.
In our world, you can't do anything. All you can do is ask questions and hope to get the other person to think and explore. And what stands out to me is that parallel here is if you make it human, you look at the day-to-day struggles, then people can actually see what it looks like, because in the absence of that, they don't know what it is. And so the stigma is pushed away. But if you can make it more tangible, they can see it. It leads to the humanization of it and the empathy, which is just fascinating how you describe that, because it makes sense to me.
You're no longer in a box, a category separate from the rest of humanity.
Yep.
You're struggling like all of us.
Yep.
I want to make a further point, too, that if we're going to solve this problem of stigma, which some people have contended rightfully, it's probably the biggest problem confronting the whole mental health field.
Mm-hmm.
It underlies lack of funding. It underlies lack of insurance coverage and treatment, et cetera, et cetera. We're going to have to partly work top-down. Well, we've got anti-discrimination laws, the Americans with Disabilities Act now.
Mm-hmm.
We've got the Affordable Care Act. It's going to make health access available for more people. We're also going to have to work bottom-up in just the ways we were talking about, changing human hearts by enhancing empathy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're going to have to work, in some ways, middle out, and I think the media play a big role here. If the common portrayals are of demonization or heroization but not real everyday stories, then stigma is going to stay maintained. And it's a fascinating fact that compared to 50, 60 years ago, the American public clearly knows more about mental illness. There's psychology courses in high school. Psychology is a popular, much more popular major in college than it ever was. Things are on TV and in the media. People know more. But at the same time, public attitudes about just about every form of mental illness have either not changed in the last 50 years or are worse. Knowledge isn't everything. It's the empathy and contact that we're still lacking.
It was funny because that was a topic I wanted to get into just before we kind of go into break, because knowledge isn't everything.
Right.
At least it hasn't proven that, because from what I understand and what I think I interpreted from your keynote was that as we've been out there, actually stigma in this space has actually gotten worse in the last 40 or 50 years as opposed to getting better. Am I misrepresenting that?
You look at these surveys done every 10 years of not just a small sample, but representative sample of whole American population, three times as many people today as in the 50s, if they hear the word mental illness, they think of dangerousness and violence.
Wow.
Now, we can think of the horrific acts of violence perpetrated by individuals in recent years, and it gets all sorts of media attention. We used to put a lot of people with mental illness in state hospitals against their will.
Mm-hmm.
We've closed 90%+ of those hospital bed slots down. So how do many people confront serious mental illness? In watching on main streets and cities, homeless people begging. And so the public face of mental illness is threatening.
Yep.
And we associate mental illness with dangers. I mean, the only way to get into a mental hospital in most states now is to be a danger to yourself or others. And people think, oh, that mental illness, that's dangerous. And even with far better media coverage in many outlets, still the predominant stories about mental illness are incompetence and violence. And so as we know more, facts are important. We don't want to be ignorant, but it's going to take empathy, not just knowledge, if we're really going to change stigma.
I like what you said. And one other point really quickly, we go to break, is you were talking earlier about the demonization of it. And as we're recording this, there's a good chance that we will air a show before this is actually played. And the topic of the show is some recent articles that were printed by the New York Times on a very tragic situation of an individual who passed away by taking some stimulants. And,
that's Richard Fee in the front page of the Sunday Times just a few weeks ago.
And I'm talking to some people to have them come on to talk about it, but it's interesting to me because I was actually literally writing it up today and thinking about the angle that I was going to come at it with. And if you read the article, it kind of portrays, you know, this kid had gotten in trouble, but he clearly didn't take responsibility in taking the drugs in that situation. And what's fascinating to me is the New York Times, CHAD, and other organizations have been trying to advocate for the community and trying to say, hey, listen, you know, there's some parity here. There's other sides of the story. In the last year or so, the New York Times has not heard these cries and have continued to print these types of stories. And so it's interesting to me because they're using the pain of the family to sensationalize the situation, inflicting pain on those in the ADHD community that could benefit by saying, hey, listen, you know, stimulants are kind of a bad thing for their own profit. And in that weird kind of loop, it's demonizing even the medications that actually can help many of these people to function more in society to actually kind of reduce some of the stigma. So it's just craziness to me.
You raise a huge point, and my colleague Richard Scheffler and I are turning in a book to our publisher literally this month, March 2013, called The ADHD Explosion, and we take up a lot of the biology and social forces about mental illness, and we talk about stigma a lot. And in fact, we take to task the New York Times for its continuing series of op-eds and editorials and opinion pieces in 2012 that really denigrate ADHD and blame individuals and families. And now, with this particular story about Richard Fee, it's not even clear he had viable ADHD. It doesn't look like the assessment was very thorough. This is a huge part of the problem.
Yep.
But this is a rare case when ADHD medications are prescribed and monitored well for people with real live ADHD. Addiction is vanishingly rare. But if the medications are used indiscriminately, the chances of substance abuse go up considerably. We need to upgrade our system of care. We need to have professionals follow the practice guidelines. We don't want stimulants out on the street for general use. But these are real-life medications for real-life people's problems. And the tenor of a lot of the media these days is quite stigmatizing.
Yep, quite. It really is. But Dr. Hinshaw, I want to run to a break real quick. Again, for our listeners out there to learn more about you, the Berkeley website, and I don't actually have it right, so could you repeat it so our listeners could write it down?
So the University of California website is www.berkeley, and that's B-E-R-K-E-L-E-Y, three E's in Berkeley, .edu, and the psychology department homepage is a click away, and my laboratory and my information is right under the psychology department's homepage, and that's the best way to get in touch.
Everybody, with that, we'll be right back after these messages.
You're listening to Attention Talk Radio. We'll return in a moment. Your life, your world, your choice. This is Attention Talk Radio.
You can't go off to school with them, but we can. Visit edgefoundation.org to learn more how an EDGE coach can help your student reach their full potential.
Make every moment count with Time Timer, a sensitive solution for ADHD time management. It shows how much time is left using a bright red disc that gets smaller as time passes. To place an order for a Time Timer, all you have to remember is timetimer.com.
Experience the difference with a top-notch ADHD coach. Find one at the ADD Coach Academy, the only comprehensive ADHD coach training program accredited by the International Coach Federation. Go to addca.com and click on Find a Coach.
We are CHAD, the nation's leading nonprofit organization serving the community impacted by ADHD. CHAD and Attention Magazine provide science-based information about ADHD to families, professionals, the media, and the general public. Attention is the only publication in which your paid advertising promotes the mission of leadership, advocacy, research, education, and support for the ADHD community. Interested? Advertise in Attention Magazine and CHAD's website at chadd.org or call 240-487-2314.
And now, back to Attention Talk Radio.
Welcome back, everybody, to this incredible conversation on stigma and ADHD with Dr. Stephen Henshaw. Dr. Henshaw, we've kind of covered a lot of the background, and as it's amazing to me. There's so many layers to stigma to kind of peel it back and kind of understand it. And we've talked about it in detail, but I want to kind of shift the focus and talk about, you know, some of the keys and kind of how we move forward. And you've alluded to this, and you said it in indirect ways, but Rob Tedisco had been on the show in some shows that we did a while ago, but he had a comment: secrecy breeds shame. And when I think about secrecy breeds shame, and I think about the internalized stigma, is secrecy actually can help people kind of internalize it, which is my interpretation. That's not really what we should be doing moving forward. So can we talk about some of the key things to be thinking about, both in terms of reversing this trend and some positive things so people have something to look towards?
Absolutely. And when I gave my keynote at CHAD last November for the 25th conference, I talked about my own family experience of living in a family of very serious mental illness. My dad would disappear from time to time, sometimes for a year at a time, and nobody talked about it. Well, it turns out he went to mental hospitals. They thought he had schizophrenia. He actually had misdiagnosed bipolar disorder. But the point was, my sister and I were little. The psychiatrist and the doctors told my mom and dad, never tell your children about mental illness, they can't understand. And so that was the discussion. There was no discussion. And what happens when a kid knows something is wrong? Parents are arguing. Parent disappears. Well, better to blame yourself than to think you're living in just a random, cruel world. Mm-hmm. It's a real internalization process. Silence breeds wondering. It breeds internalization and self-blame. My high school and college years, as I started to learn about my dad's life, were better than the silence I'd lived in before, but now it was terrifying because I couldn't talk about it with anybody else except my dad, who'd finally, in some ways, come out of the closet and decided to open up and go against doctor's orders. When that happens, people don't know how to seek treatment. People live in a perpetual state of mystery, and so the antidote is communication, opening doors rather than closing them.
Mm-hmm.
So part of this is disclosure, and many mental health advocates say the best thing you can do is not live a secret life, come out of the closet, tell people, and I think that's true. Timing is everything. Do you always tell a prospective employer before you have the job about your history? Or do you get that job, and then if there's a good employee assistance system, and you can use Americans with Disabilities Act, disclose then. The first time you meet someone, you're maybe going to go out with them. Do you tell them all your dirty laundry? Probably not. So timing and knowing how and when to disclose is important.
Hey, can I
the opposite of you never tell because it's too shameful is destined to failure.
I can't help, we did a show about 2 years ago with Dr. Ari Tuchman on the concept to disclose or not to disclose. And if anybody out there is interested in learning more, it was a great show. He talked about the difference between an excuse and an explanation.
Yeah.
And the notion of disclosing the symptoms and not necessarily the diagnosis.
Yep.
And when you disclose the diagnosis, it's like you know, breaking a window, just one tap, it'll take you forever to put those pieces back together or the cat's out of the bag. But just in that space, I mean, literally, Dr. Tuchman did a great job. It's like a 45-minute hour show with the whole area. So if that's something you're interested in, go dig that up in our archives. So, Dr. Henshaw, the notion of having the conversations around not being secret as a means not to breed that shame, that's definitely one of them. Another thing that kind of struck me from the conference, and there's a few other things here, but this one, just resilience, strength, and courage, and
yeah,
the ability to kind of get up. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Most people in our field talk about bad things, symptoms and impairments. And, you know, when I was in grad school back some years ago, and I remember one of the professors said, hey, look, if your car's not working well and you go to a mechanic, and the mechanic might say, hey, your transmission's in great shape. The power steering was, yeah, but my car's broken. The mechanic needs to know what's wrong. People in the mental health professions need to know what's wrong in order to help fix it.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, in a very bold statement, I will say that human beings are not exactly analogous to cars, right?
Yep.
Ours are mechanical things. Human beings are complex spiritual and physical mm-hmm. beings, and maybe for many people the best way to get at the deficit or weakness is through building strength. So we can't focus on just the negative. We've got to figure out ways of strength building and finding the motivation to remediate problems and learn skills that aren't in the repertoire yet. Yet, everybody's got strengths and weaknesses. The weaknesses, so-called, that many people with ADHD have are in just those areas that our society really values, like being organized and doing well in school and self-regulating. So the co-equal focus has to be on reducing symptoms and problems and impairments and building strengths, and that's where resilience comes in.
And
how do you beat the odds? How do you overcome adversity? And it can't just be a deficit model. It's got to be a strength-based model, too.
I can't help but insert this. It was powerful to me. Mark Katz does a Dr. Katz does a presentation. I think it's entitled, "There's Nothing So Wrong With Us That What's Right With Us Can't Fix."
Yeah.
And that notion is just, I mean, it's really, really kind of powerful, and that focus on what you can do. I know in coaching, people come to me, one of my favorite things is time management, and I'll say, "Let's do that next week," and invariably they'll call me close to being on time, and they'll say they want coaching on time management, and I go off on like, "Oh, you must be, look at all the progress you've made this week," and kind of going on, and there's this awkward pause, and they go, "What are you talking about?" I go, "Well, you made this call on time." And I go, "How'd you do it?" And most of them have never paid attention to what they did right.
Yeah.
They only if they had 30 appointments a week, they can remember, they focus on the 3 that did wrong, but they can't remember the 27 they did right. Furthermore, they don't think about what I did in order to do that, because the solutions to what they do is in what they did right, not what they did wrong.
Couldn't agree with you more. Classic example, yeah.
Absolutely. Some other keys for our listeners to think about.
So, stigma reduction is not going to happen tomorrow or next week or next month or next year or next decade. Civil rights has been a big issue in our country for a long time and around the world. Emancipation Proclamation, Civil Rights Act of 64, 65, voting rights. Are we still there? Are we a fully racially tolerant society yet? No, but we've made huge strides. We've got a long way to go.
Mm-hmm.
One of the last frontiers is the stigma against mental illness. It's going to take, as we talked about a little bit ago in this program, top-down approaches, legislating, justice, outlawing discrimination. It's going to take bottom-up, people disclosing, people hearing and gaining empathy. It's going to take media portrayals, kind of this middle-out strategy of making more human portrayals. And it's going to take those sort of three rings of an approach over many years to erode away the stigma. And as we talked about at the top of the show, some parts of stereotyping and prejudice and stigma are a bit automatic. We might always be a bit wary when behavior doesn't meet our expectations or is threatening. But we're humans. We can think. We've got big frontal lobes. We can empathize. We're deeply empathic. It's going to take a lot of work to get at this. But if we don't fix the stigma, the research and the treatment and the service delivery are always going to lag behind. So we've got to work on the stigma just as much as we have to work on the more traditional clinical things of medication, coaching, treatment, et cetera.
It sounds to me that some of the things that stand out, the lessons that I'm taking from this, is number one, get an accurate diagnosis and get responsive treatment, because those two things for someone who's out there can kind of help them immensely, both on their own self-esteem and kind of what's going on. The other one is the notion of ending the secrecy of it, talk about it so you know what's kind of going on. But the thing that stands out to me more than anything that you said, Dr. Henshaw, is the convey the day-to-day struggles, humanize it to lead to empathy. The more I reflect back on that, to me, that's the ticket. It really makes a lot of sense to me when I kind of look around, and it's going to take everybody, not just one person in the ADHD community, to make this thing happen.
Famous people who've talked about stigma, the famous psychologist Gordon Allport 50, 60 years ago talked about the solution to stigma is contact and widening the circle of one's in-group to include former out-groups or formerly devalued groups. And what we're talking about is we're all humans. We're all in this together. We all struggle despite the differences we have. And the empathy about deeply human struggles in some ways may be the ultimate solution.
Mm. Before we wrap things up, any last comments or anything that we haven't covered that particularly you think that should be shared?
So a final kind of point is, and you just mentioned this a second ago, getting people access to the best of evidence-based care is a real antidote to stigma.
Mm-hmm.
Because then everybody in society sees that troublesome symptoms can be abridged and skills can be built. Treatment's essential. But it's not, for ADHD and mental illness, everything. Let's take racial prejudice and stigma as a counterexample. I know a really good way to erase racial prejudice and stigma. Just change everybody to my skin color. Then I don't have a problem with anybody.
Uh-huh.
Racial differences are an innate difference between people. We've got to promote and demand tolerance and acceptance.
Mm.
Now, you get something like ADHD or bipolar disorder, those are mental illnesses. Treatment's essential because symptoms can get under control and people can lead far happier and more productive lives. On the other hand, does treatment reduce every behavioral difference? No, and it shouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
So for psychopathologies, illnesses, behavioral struggles, treatment's important to really help contain symptoms and develop skills, but at the same time, society has to appreciate that there's always going to be differences behaviorally and emotionally across people. We can't tolerate random acts of violence. We can't tolerate behavior that goes against the grain so much that people can't learn. On the other hand, it's not just treatment and getting the individual fixed. It's acceptance of different lifestyles. And so stigma reduction for ADHD and mental illness really works both ways.
As you described this, a show that we did pop in my head. Any listeners are out there who are intrigued by this and want to just kind of learn is Dr. Henshaw. Last June we did a show on being ADHD and being gay, and it was a fascinating show. I learned so much, across the board, because there's a behavior thing, there's some stigma and stuff that's associated, and our guest kind of went into like how the gay community has managed it and kind of compared and contrasted a little bit with the ADHD community, and it was just fascinating. So if you're enjoying this show and you're interested, I encourage you to go back up and look in our archives. And again, that show, I think, was the middle of June in 2012. So, Dr. Henshaw, thank you very much for coming on the show. I had high hopes of this show, but you knocked the ball off the cover. I think that our listeners out there can really see there's a lot to pay attention to here. You can generalize it, but as we've broke it down, we've covered about the different properties, the different subtypes, the different things that people can do, some of the challenges that are in there. I think it's been very enlightening. So, again, thank you very much for coming on.
It's been a pleasure to be on, and thanks for the really good questions to get us deeply into this material.
Absolutely. So, everybody, with that, thanks again for listening, and catch us next week for another great edition of Attention Talk Radio. Take care.